This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today my guest is Chris Gibson, co-founder and CEO of Recursion Pharmaceuticals. While technology has brought down the cost of creating many products, drug discovery or pharmaceutical development, unfortunately, is not one of them. Moore's Law tells us that the cost of semiconductors drops in half every 2 years. And just a few years ago, you would have had to be fairly affluent to have your gene sequence analyzed. Today, companies like Ancestry.com and 23andMe will do this test for less than the cost of a family meal at McDonald's. Yet despite these enormous gains in other industries, the cost and time required to bring new drugs to market has skyrocketed over the past decade. Join me today to hear how Recursion Pharmaceuticals is bringing big data, artificial intelligence, and image recognition to discover new treatments for debilitating and deadly diseases, and how the prospects of a quantum leap in this field was promising enough that Chris Gibson dropped out of medical school to pursue this vision. Chris, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start off and tell the audience, how does traditional drug discovery work?
Well, there's a lot of different ways that people try to discover drugs, but typically it's a 10 to 15 year process, and 99% of everything that people start working on ends up failing in the end. So it's a battlefield littered with failures, so to speak. And typically what people do is they come up with a hypothesis about how something in biology is working and how it relates to a disease. And then they try and find a chemical compound or other sort of entity that can help fix whatever they believe is wrong. The problem is that biology is really, really complex. And reducing it down to just a single sort of silver bullet can be really, really hard. And while there are lots of drugs that have made it to the market and are treating people that have come out of this sort of approach, ultimately, there are still thousands of diseases where even in the 21st century, we don't have any treatments at all. And so we're trying to understand how we can look at biology more as a system, and probably a system that is too complex for any human to hold in their head. And that sort of was the birth of Recursion.
Okay. And I want to move on to Recursion's approach. But before we leave traditional, I've heard it takes about 10 years to bring a drug to market. And it costs about $1 billion. Is that in the ballpark of new drug discovery traditionally?
It's even higher now. It's 10 to 15 years and now about $2.5 billion. And that includes the cost of all the failures. So that's sort of dividing all the R&D in the industry divided by the number of actual programs that make it to the market. But that's still an incredible, incredible amount of money. And I think it's really relevant because I'm sure on lots of shows, people are talking about healthcare prices. And this is not the only driver of increasing healthcare prices, but it's one of them. And so we need to find ways to be able to generate new medicines that are helpful for people, but at the same time, not continue to increase the price.
Okay. So let's talk about those new processes, and Recursion is doing things very differently. Talk to us about how your process works for new drug discovery.
Right. So we're really focused on using images as the core of what we do. And the way I sort of like to talk about this is genetics cause all kinds of changes in biology, right? So you and I have different color eyes, and that's driven by specific genes. And if I were to use facial recognition algorithms, I could recognize how you and I are different, not just in our eyes, but our nose, our ears, and everything. And the same thing holds at the level of individual human cells. So we can actually see what a disease looks like in an individual cell. So we do hundreds of thousands of experiments every week in real human cells. And at the end of that week, we take pictures using microscopes, and we take about 2 million of these pictures. And we use computer vision, it's a lot like facial recognition algorithms, to try and understand how each of those cells look different. And then we find drugs that make them look healthy again. And we don't have a hypothesis. And I think this is the key, what makes us different, is we're not trying to understand biology and let that direct where we go. We're trying to let biology direct us where to go. The cell tells us the answer, as opposed to us trying to tell biology what the answer is.
So one of your team members did an interview that was available on YouTube. It was 2.5 minutes, just kind of blurb from it. And he shared some numbers. And he said, you guys are building a computational model of 1,000 diseases in 10 different cell types. And then he said, we're looking at the effects of 5,000 drugs. And then we're looking at 10,000 cells on the impact of that. And in each cell, you're looking at 1,000 parameters. So I did the math. And if you do that, that ends up being 500 trillion. The data set is 500 trillion for each one of those experiments. And just to put, you know, it's hard for people to visualize what a trillion is. If each second, if you looked at seconds, 1 trillion seconds is 32 years, just to put in context how big 500 trillion is for that simple example that I went through. So how do you analyze that much data?
Well, I think this is something that's only been possible in the last few years. So we see, you know, in Silicon Valley, you hear a lot about big data and artificial intelligence, and you hear about social networks, a lot of information about Facebook in the news recently. And all of these are groups who are looking at data sets that are even bigger than the one that, that we've generated. And the computational horsepower really to be able to do that has probably gone down in cost at a rate that has exceeded Moore's Law even. So what we do every week in our laboratory now might have cost $1 million 10 years ago, just on the computer side. And now we can do it for just a fraction of that. And this is, you know, these are data warehouses where you can store massive amounts of data, and then cloud computing, where actually we don't have most of the CPUs and GPUs that we use to do our calculations at our facility. We actually put all of our data in the cloud and use computers in the cloud to do all of our calculations because we're bursty. And so that turns out to be, we would need the equivalent of a supercomputer to do our calculations, but we only need it once a week at the end of an experiment. And so we can use the cloud.
So you can rent that.
Exactly.
We
can
rent
that.
Essentially.
Right.
Okay. Great. Now, most drug discovery companies are run by PhDs and medical doctors. I'm guessing how you've described this, data scientists play a key role on your team. Talk to us about how many data scientists you have and how important that is to the process.
Perfect. Yeah. So I would say about 15% of our company are data scientists. And that's an extraordinarily high number. They play an integral role in everything that we do at Recursion, and in fact are seated right next to the biologists as we design experiments. And I think this is fundamentally unique and requires a startup like Recursion. There's lots of great computational biologists and data scientists working in the industry, lots of people generally that are incredible working in the industry. But they've been working within a framework in which they look at each other sort of like silos. And fundamentally, we've built from the ground up a relationship where biology and data science share decisions. And what that means is that you get definitely some struggle and some challenge as these two groups try to understand each other and learn each other's language. But you also get the best elements of the decision making from both the biologists and the data scientists. And I like to say that the biologists are helping us decide what questions to ask, and the data scientists are helping us to decide the best way, sort of statistically, to ask those questions.
Yeah, it's kind of an unnatural marriage, at least by today's standard, right? Having these two groups work together, because they are very different. Data scientists, people primarily think of Facebook, Google, the high-tech companies. Biologists, more life science type companies, and bringing those together. And I think we're going to see a lot of this in the future. I think every industry, data scientists are going to become an integral part of.
Absolutely.
But you guys are kind of on the cutting edge of that.
We hope so.
So very interesting. If you're just joining us this morning, our guest today is Chris Gibson. He's the co-founder and CEO of Recursion Pharmaceuticals, a firm that's dramatically changing the process for discovering new drugs to treat various human diseases. So you talked about image recognition. So essentially you can see these cells in the disease state. You can bathe them in thousands of different drugs. And you can see, was there a change using image recognition? Was there a change in that disease state? And then all of a sudden that kind of flags that drug as potentially being something that,
exactly.
that is of interest. I'm curious, can you patent the idea of using image recognition in drug discovery?
Well, we filed patents around that. So
to find out, right?
We'll find out soon. Our expectation is that there are certain elements of what we're doing that we can patent. And we're filing lots of patents in that space. And then we can also file patents around individual discoveries we make. And with more than 7,000 diseases without a treatment, there's a lot of room for new ideas and new discoveries in biology.
Okay, so there's a very famous case here in Salt Lake related to drug testing, life science company and IP. It's Myriad Genetics. They patented BRCA1 and BRCA2 as far as being able to use that as a potential predictor for breast cancer. Case went all the way to the Supreme Court, 2013. Supreme Court said, sorry, you can't do that. Does that ruling have any impact on your company?
So we don't know yet. Our expectation is that it does not. The sorts of patents that we're filing are around the algorithm and the process and not around the biology itself. And I think, you know, the Supreme Court came down and obviously much more thoughtful and subtle than what I'll say. But essentially, you can't patent biology itself, right? And I think that was the final decision. So we're not trying to patent the biology. We're trying to patent the discoveries about how to affect the biology and the process by which you ask those questions.
Okay. I want to ask a follow-on question. You mentioned that you're using your process, really looking at orphan diseases. And you mentioned that there's 7,000 quote-unquote rare diseases. Why start with the rare diseases? I would think you'd want to find a disease that everybody, as many people as possible, suffer from because it's a bigger market for you.
Yeah, there's a number of reasons, and many of them are technical in nature relating to the kinds of tools that we use. Rare disease and genetic disease in particular was where we started. Based on those technical reasons. There's also some regulatory reasons. So as people know, it's a long, difficult process to get a drug to patients because you have to establish that that drug is safe, or at least the risk-benefit ratio is reasonable. And this is working with the FDA. And there are certain elements of developing drugs for rarer diseases where the FDA works more closely with you and helps you along the path, and you can move a little bit faster. So for us, we think of rare disease as our training wheels. And actually, since the company has started, we've now moved into some really big indications, like ulcerative colitis is something we're working on right now, which is something that millions of people suffer from. So I would say it's sort of a technical reason why we started in rare disease, but there's no reason we can't work much more broadly.
Okay. Speaking of the FDA, in the open, I talked about how the cost of a lot of technology has dropped dramatically over the last decade. Not the case in your field. Drug discovery is very expensive. Is there some systemically, and in fact, you corrected my numbers and said it's even worse than what I thought it was. Is there some systemically going on, and is a big part of that just the bureaucracy at the FDA, or is there something outside of that that's making it more expensive to discover drugs?
I think this is many factorial, and this is a hotly debated subject by many, many people. There are lots of academic analyses that suggest that the regulation by the FDA is not the primary driver of the increase in costs. Our belief is that the primary driver is that the entire industry has been built to discover treatments for diseases where we can understand the biology as humans, and we can sort of take the disease and say, it's a problem with this protein or this pathway in biology. And in reality, many of the diseases are going to be problems in a really complex network of hundreds of pathways and proteins interacting. And it's not something you'll be able to hold in your head as a single human. And I think that's where, at least we believe at Recursion, we're starting to see, you know, that we've discovered the drugs that can treat the diseases that are sort of easy to understand as people.
Okay, let's take a short break, and when we return, we will continue our conversation with Chris Gibson, co-founder and CEO of Recursion Pharmaceuticals.
You're listening to The Bottom Line on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Chris Gibson, co-founder and CEO of Recursion Pharmaceuticals, a firm using big data, artificial intelligence, and image recognition to speed up the discovery of new drugs for some awful diseases. So we talked about Recursion and your process. You're a relatively young company. I want to turn now and kind of talk about your journey and the journey of your team. And I guess the best place to start is tell me about your team. Who was the initial core folks that helped you start the company?
Right. So myself, my academic advisor when I was doing my PhD work at the University of Utah, Dean Lee, and then a undergraduate friend of mine, Blake Borgeson.
And so Dr. Lee was your academic advisor.
Right.
And so he had a full-time job. Now, this was during your PhD. You also went to medical school. Was mm-hmm. that concurrent? Were you doing your PhD and your medical degree at the same time?
Yeah, it's a combined program.
Okay.
Which I did not finish.
Okay, so he had a job, and it's for folks that don't know, we've had several of the researchers from the university on as guests, but it's not unusual for a University of Utah researcher to come up with a discovery.
Right.
And then to work with somebody to commercialize.
Exactly.
Now, it's a much lower risk for the researcher than it is for the person that comes on to run the company.
Exactly.
He's got his job. If it works, great. If it doesn't work, he's still a tenured professor at the University of Utah.
Right.
For you, it was different.
Mm-hmm.
For you, you were finishing up your PhD, but to start the company, you had to drop out of medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And not a lot of people do that. So talk to us about that, and what was it about this opportunity that made you say, you know what, I'm going to do this?
So it was exciting and dramatic, but not quite as dramatic as that in that they gave me a leave of absence to start. So if things went horribly wrong in the first 6 months, I was going to be able to come back. And that was very generous of the university to do that. But ultimately, it was a decision for me around the impact that I wanted to have in my career. And I was very lucky to be in a position where my wife was already a physician, and she was sort of giving back to the world in a way that I was excited about. She actually works with patients with ALS, which is another devastating disease that we're actually working on. And I also saw when she came home every day, you know, I'd hear the stories about her day and know that she worked with 6 patients or 8 patients or 5 patients on each of those days. And I sat there thinking about the potential to do something where we might affect 1 million patients or 10 million patients or 100 million people. And it seemed improbable at the time. It seemed like the most likely outcome was failure. That is the most likely outcome of any company that starts.
Unfortunately, yeah.
And so I, at the same time, decided that the potential for impact was high enough that it was worth taking that risk. And I had an amazing supportive family, and they sort of put me in the position to take that shot.
Okay, so you put yourself in a position where you lowered the risk, right? You took a leave. You didn't drop out of medical school. You took a leave of absence. I just want to take a moment and share with folks. You know, oftentimes the best decision is not A or B, but it's some combination of both. And I love the fact that you left the door open. You didn't, you know, sometimes in entrepreneurship, people say, burn the bridges. You know, you got to fully commit. Well, why take on risks that you don't need? So I applaud you for doing the leave of absence. And oftentimes there is a solution there. Now, Dr. Lee, when you told him you wanted to start this process and start a company and drop out of medical school, he didn't just say, hey, Chris, that's a great idea. He realized the magnitude of this. And I understand from my research, he actually called your parents in and said, let's sit down and talk about this.
Yes.
What was that talk like?
That was a little bit embarrassing as an almost 30-year-old at the time. But that, you know, Dean was thinking about my best interest. He believed very much in the work that I wanted to do, but he also knows that serendipity would play a role in the success or failure of the company. And he also, I think, knew that I was likely to be a good physician. You know, he was an MD PhD, so a physician that did research, and so he often would quiz us around, you know, questions around medicine, and I think he knew that I and medicine was giving something up if I left. But he sat down and he made sure everybody understood the magnitude of the decision. And as soon as he knew that I really knew what I was getting into, he was fully supportive and joined as one of the co-founders, actually, of the company.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Chris Gibson. He is the co-founder and CEO of Recursion Pharmaceuticals, a firm dramatically changing the process for discovering new drugs to treat various human diseases. Okay, so you're working with Dr. Lee. You make the decision you want to do this. We have this meeting with your parents. Yeah, and actually, you said it was a bit embarrassing for that. You know, when I first read that, I thought that sounded wise to me.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? I mean, in hindsight, was that a good thing to include your parents in on that? Or in hindsight, would you have said, you know what, I'm almost 30, I can make this decision?
Absolutely. And in fact, I'd already looped my parents into that decision. I I have a family who have in various ways all tried to go build something themselves in their lives. And so they had great counsel for me. That being said, walking through the laboratory at almost 30 with my parents in tow to sit down in Dean's office felt a little bit like being back in the principal's office.
I can see that. What was some of the best advice you think your parents gave you as you were thinking about doing this?
I think they could tell that I was passionate about it, and they just said to go for it. They said, if you're passionate about something, it's worth trying. And, you know, there's the oft quoted, you don't want to be sitting on your deathbed thinking about all the things you didn't do. And this felt like one of those decisions for me. So it made it pretty easy.
Yeah, there's also a smart way to do it. There's a movie that I like. It's at least the first half of the movie is inspirational. It's Clint Eastwood's Million Dollar Baby. Morgan Freeman kind of narrates some in the background. I don't know if you've seen the movie, but it's about boxing, and they say, you know, show me a boxer that's all hard, and I'll show you a boxer that's about to get his butt whooped. And there's truth to it. What I like about your story is you had the passion, but you did things in a way that you weren't betting at all. And I think too often entrepreneurs put themselves in a position unnecessarily where they're betting at all. We should also share with the audience that you had some background and some training in entrepreneurship before all this came to be. You had an opportunity to go to Stanford Business School for a summer program. I shared with you in the green room. I got my MBA from Stanford. I know what an incredible opportunity that is. Tell us how Stanford got on your radar screen, why you decided to do that as a PhD student before all of this, mm-hmm. and what kind of drove that.
So I always have had an interest in combining science and business. In undergraduate work at Rice, I actually did a second degree in business and had gotten very, very deep into the scientific side in my MD-PhD, as you can imagine. And I was actually on a treadmill at a random workout facility and saw a Stanford alumni magazine and read about this program called Ignite in that magazine. And Ignite was essentially a mini MBA for scientists or people who were not in the business space. It's mostly directed for Stanford students, but they take a small number of outside Stanford students. So I went back and, you know, this tells you a little bit about the support from Dean. I went back, talked to Dean about why I wanted to go to that program to sort of start thinking a little bit more about whether this idea was real before I took the leave of absence. And he actually paid for me to go himself. So I went to that program, spent, I think, about 6 weeks in Palo Alto living at Stanford. You know, again, incredible supportive family. We had a three-month-old child at the time, my wife and I, and she was here, a physician, building her career while I, you know, went off to Palo Alto for the summer. And, you know, this is, I think, an important point just to make is that any entrepreneur that's having any success is not doing it by themselves in a bubble. They're doing it with a lot of support from a lot of people.
Yeah, they have a lot of support, and they also make big sacrifices. So you had a three-month-old mm-hmm. at home here in Utah. You left your first child.
First child.
I can remember when my oldest daughter was 3 months old, and it was, unfortunately, I had a job at the time where I was traveling a lot. And it was really, really hard to leave. So I know that was probably the biggest factor in your decision is I'm going to be gone during this incredible period where your child's changing almost on a weekly basis.
Exactly. It's been, I think, a real tough internal struggle for me about how to balance being a good dad and being also a good entrepreneur. And ultimately, you know, I make sacrifices like taking the red eye home so I can be there in the morning to take the kids to school, which I'm getting, I think, too old to do these days. Those red eyes seem
red
harder
eyes
and harder.
Tough.
You know, but also I think it's really important for my kids to see me doing something that I love and that I care about, and for them to see their mom doing that too. So that's to me that fine balance, right? You want to be present in their lives and teach them a lot, but it's also important for them to see passion and hard work.
Okay. So getting back to Stanford, it's 6 weeks, it's intensive. And I know part of that program, we were talking in the green room before the interview, they asked you to come up with a business idea and start pursuing it. What was the business idea you pursued while you were at Stanford?
It was essentially the very, very seed of Recursion. And I came with the idea that I would take my PhD work to try and use images to find new treatments, and I would try and find treatments for a small number of diseases. And as you know, having been in the Bay Area, people think very, very big there. And I went to lots of events at lots of different places around the valley and met with lots of people and was amazed by the magnitude of ideas that people had. And over those weeks, I slowly morphed with my team who was working on the idea with me from trying to find treatments for a few more diseases, which is how the world usually works. Drug companies start up, they find one treatment, then they find another one, then they find another one. They don't try and find all the treatments sort of all in parallel. And we came up with a way in which we could morph the technology that we had made into something where we could potentially find hundreds of treatments in parallel. And that was the big revelation of my time at Stanford, was taking this from a sort of, you know, 1 to 10 idea and going and turning it into a 0 to 1 idea.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I spent about 10 years in the Bay Area. I've lived here in Utah for about 20. And when people ask me, you know, what's different about the ecosystem there than here, I still share with them it's the scale of the vision. And I try to encourage entrepreneurs to think bigger. Again, we were talking in the green room. You met one of my classmates, Steve Jervison, who's a venture capitalist at a firm called Draper Fisher Jervison. And to give the audience an idea of big thinking, I mean, they're thinking about, you know, how to, DFJ is a backer in SpaceX, and SpaceX's ultimate goal is to build a human colony on Mars and to have an alternative planet for us available at some point. I mean, that's big thinking. And oftentimes, the big ideas are not that much riskier than some of these scaled back ideas, but the impact can be quite a bit different. So I'm glad you took that away from the program. Do you think the scale of Recursion would be at the level that it is? And we're going to talk about the amount of money you raised. It's very impressive. It's in the tens of millions of dollars. Do you think the scale of Recursion would have been the same had you not spent that 6 weeks in the Bay Area?
Absolutely not. I think that was formative for us thinking about the scale. I can imagine there are other ways I could have spent time in Cambridge, Mass, or other places where perhaps I would have come up with, and to be clear, I didn't come up with this alone. I had a team of people, and we sort of, through many late nights of whiteboarding, and we still have pictures of the night we kind of finally drew the big idea up on the whiteboard, and we all sort of sat back and said, you know, this in our mind, we're trying to build a map of biology. That's as big as going to the moon or going to Mars.
What do you mean by a map of biology?
So if you want to understand where to go, you use a map. And right now in biology, we don't understand how all the various pieces fit together. And so people study little tiny pieces of biology in isolation. Beyond just finding drugs that can treat diseases in the short term, we're taking all of these hundreds of millions of images that we're generating and building sort of an in silico computational framework that understands how it all works in biology. And, you know, the way to think of it is a map. That's kind of the way I think of it. But ultimately, it's a system that will enable us to predict what will happen before we do any experiment. And that's ultimately, you know, most of the money we're spending as a company is on doing experiments. But if you keep track of all those experiments, you can start to see patterns in the data and you can start to predict what will happen next, right? We all know Foothill is going to have a lot of traffic on a weekday morning. And it's because of that pattern recognition. And the same thing is true of certain pathways in biology. So that's a little bit about
the
app.
Good analogy. If you're just joining us this morning, our guest today is Chris Gibson. He's the co-founder and CEO of Recursion Pharmaceuticals, a firm dramatically changing the process for discovering new drugs to treat various human diseases. You know, we're talking about how you're spending money on these various experiments and the pattern recognition, which is really where artificial intelligence really has its strength. Computers are now much better at pattern recognition than humans are. And it's using that pattern recognition along with the image recognition to help see if there's been a change when you bathe it in certain drugs. It's very costly, though, and I want to talk about the money side of things. Just last fall, you raised a big Series B, which is usually the third round. The way it typically works for startups is you raise a seed fund. which is primarily angels, friends, and family. A small round. The next one's a Series A and then a Series B. It's getting harder and harder to raise the Series A, Series B. Your B was huge. It was $60 million. Your A a couple years before that was also fairly substantial, $15 million. But I want to start with the seed fund. Mm-hmm. There's a database, Crunchbase, that shares on companies. And according to them, you did two seed rounds. The first one was for $130,000. The next one was for $170,000. Had you raised money before? And what was that process like raising that initial seed fund?
I had never raised money before. So it was all new at the time. And both of those initials, so the very first $130,000 was actually the three co-founders putting our own skin in the game. And as a graduate student at the time, that was my wife and I's entire life savings. So there was some real risk besides just sort of taking the leave of absence from school. So the three founders put that money in. The $170,000 was friends and family. These are folks that were basically betting on the team. And in particular, my co-founder Blake and I, it helped a lot for our credibility that we had Dean on board. But these were people that had met us or even taught us at some point, and they were putting in $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 of their savings to take a bet on people that they believed in. And after that, we went on to raise a $1 million and then a $1.6 million sort of follow-on seed round from more professional angel groups.
Okay. What advice would you give an entrepreneur? You know, I hear a lot of entrepreneurs say, well, if I knew I could raise money for this idea, I'd pursue it. Mm-hmm. The reality is we all at some point in our life are raising money for the first time. So what advice would you give an entrepreneur that's facing that situation?
I think the best advice that I would give is to build relationships and focus on relationships. And then also to, besides building those relationships and managing them over time, to be upfront and honest. One of the things we heard the most from people who invested in us, and I mean this starting at the seed round all the way through more recently with some of these very, very well-known investors, was that it felt like a breath of fresh air because we were upfront about limitations and things that might not work well and challenges we thought we would face or had faced. And so I think that gave us a lot of credibility. And we were very upfront with people about the risk, especially in the friends and family round. We had a professor from the university who invested in that round because he knew me. But it was very important to sit down with him and say, you should only do this if you feel like you can really lose this money.
Because that's the most likely outcome.
That is the most likely outcome, right?
Unfortunately.
And despite all of the excitement I had and all the confidence I had in the science, we still had to convince the rest of the world and partners that this would work. And so there's just a tremendous amount of risk. And I think when I've now started to be in the position sometimes to hear pitches, not yet as an angel investor, but just at various sorts of events, I think sort of you want to hear somebody who truly believes in what they're doing and truly has an exciting vision, but is well aware of all the reasons why it's going to fail. And they aren't trying to hide that.
Yeah, no, I think that's great advice. Would your counsel to somebody that's never raised money before is just do it? You know,
absolutely.
It's uncomfortable for everybody, but you got to do it. And looking back now, I mean, you've raised six, seven different rounds between the seed, the Series A, and the B. Is it something you enjoy? Is it something that's still pretty daunting to you? Or what's your views on how challenging it is to raise money now?
I really enjoy doing the money raising, and not because of the actual raising of the money, but because you end up sitting in a room with folks who have seen so many different ideas, and they've seen the failure modes for so many different ideas. And they are very often the ones that help to illustrate to us what our blind spots are. So they'll come back with a question, and in some cases, we had not thought about that risk. And those are actually the investors you want to get invested in your company, right? The ones that are helping you.
This is great advice because these are people that are thinking about putting money in. So this is not theoretical concerns or theoretical suggestions. These are very thoughtful people that have seen a lot of different companies, both succeed and fail.
Right. And the sorts of investors who can challenge you and add value in terms of identifying risks are exactly the ones that you want to have invested in your company.
More often than not, when I talk to entrepreneurs, once they've gone through the process of raising capital, and most people are successful, at least at the seed round, if they're committed, if they have a decent idea, and if they're not successful, you know, it's probably society giving feedback that this probably isn't your idea. You know, go back to the drawing board. It's not a rejection of you. It's a suggestion that you not spend the next 7 to 10 years of your life on this idea. So it's a gift in some ways when you get rejected on that. But most people that I know that have gone out to raise capital have succeeded, and it changes you in a better way. It gives you a lot of confidence that you didn't have before. And most people like yourself say, you know what, I actually enjoy the process of raising capital now. You get great ideas. The other thing is you meet new people and you're building new relationships, and it's not as scary as people think.
Right, and I think you know, investors have a certain stereotype, and what I have found is that even the investors who passed and did not invest in our company, because both we and they believe in relationships, I still get emails introducing me to someone and adding value from these investors a year, 2 years, 3 years later. And I think it's really important to, you know, we talked earlier about sort of burning bridges. You don't want to do that with your investors, even when they pass, right? You want to thank them for their input, understand why they passed. Sometimes it is a real reason related to your company, a real risk that you need to manage. And sometimes it's just not the right fit for the sorts of investors that, you know, that they're managing money typically of other people or funds, pension funds or other sorts of things. And sometimes your risk profile doesn't fit their risk profile, and it's nothing about the company itself.
Yep. And on the other side, you're choosing your investors as well. And you're in a fortunate situation. You've made some great progress. Your company is very promising. I mentioned your Series B you raised is $60 million. That's a lot of money. So you're choosing who you want as your investors. I know the lead investor on your Series B was a firm called Data Collective. And both the firm as well as the person you're going to be interacting with. Now, in Data Collective's case, it's the managing partner is joining your board, Zachary Bogue. Am I pronouncing
yes.
last name correct? Zachary Bogue. What was it about that group that said, this is an investor we want on board?
So Data Collective has made more bets at the intersection of biology and computation than any other investment group that I know of. So they're incredibly familiar with the space. They also make big bets. They're in companies that are trying to work in outer space and other sorts of industries like we talked about. And so, you know, they generally fit the criteria. But they also had invested a very small amount of money in our Series A round, and we had worked with them over time and gotten to know them really well. And Zach is an incredibly well-connected individual who's incredibly thoughtful and intelligent, former attorney and now doing Data Collective. And ultimately, it was clear to us from the relationship we had built with them over time that they were going to be thoughtful and make introductions for us and help us think through problems. And I would really push folks, if they're thinking about going out to raise money, get to know investors and spend time with them. And even if they pass, keep them in the loop, because they could end up, or in the case of Data Collective, they didn't pass, but they put a very small investment in the A round. And then they watched us execute and we got to know them. And ultimately they led our Series B.
Yeah, the point of parity for every investment firm is I'll have money, right? But that's where it ends. And at that point, it's, you know, what are they bringing to the table and who's going to be the best investor for you? And it sounds like Data Collective, is from what you've said, it's a perfect match for where you guys are at this stage. We've got to start wrapping up, but I've got a couple last questions for you. So you've been at Recursion Pharmaceutical for a while now. You guys have been working hard. What, as you look back over those years, what's been the most challenging part of that process, and then what's been the most rewarding?
I think it's the same answer, actually. I think the most challenging thing has been the people, and I mean this not in a bad way, but when I went into this as a scientist, I thought that the science would be the hard part, and that managing people, which I had never done before, would be the easy part. Turns out it's exactly the opposite of that. Managing people is significantly more difficult than the science, especially when you've never done it or really been trained in it, right? I mean, I had an undergraduate degree in business, but I never really practically managed people. And having a team who has helped me grow in managing, I think, has been kind of the best part. And seeing that team flourish and seeing, you know, one of the guys who was at Stanford and on my team, he finished his MD, PhD at Stanford and then moved to Salt Lake City and joined our company. And watching him go through the same process about a year or two after I did of realizing how much harder management is than science, I think that's been both the best element of the company so far for me, the most rewarding, seeing the growth of the team, and also the most challenging.
Yeah, it actually leads. I'm glad you said that because it leads into my last question, which is, as a scientist transitioning to a business leader, and similar to raising money, everybody goes through a period of time where, you know, they've never raised money before and now they're doing it for the first time. Same thing with managing a team. We all go through a period of time where we haven't managed a team and now we're doing it for the first time. What's some of your advice to budding entrepreneurs on that?
I think the thing that I learned most from some of my colleagues, and I still work to this day. I have a long ways to go on being good at this, but I think transparency is the thing that's most important. I don't think all companies are run this way, but it's very easy to try to run a company and try to make decisions in isolation, as opposed to sitting down with the rest of your team, trying to build consensus, understand disputing views, and then sharing the reasoning for a decision behind, you know, after you make it. And it turns out this is a tremendous amount of work. Just sharing the reasoning behind the key decisions of the company takes a tremendous amount of my time to share that with the rest of the team. But it's really, really important, right? It helps people kind of tie into the mission, tie into the vision, and understand why we're doing certain things. And I think that's been the biggest sort of delta for me in management, I would say. And you could ask my team, they may think it's a small delta. I'm still working on it. But just trying to be transparent about why I'm making decisions and involving the team in those decisions.
Yeah. You know, it's how big is your team now?
Just about 100 people.
That's a lot of people. And I think one of the things you'll find too is it's communicating the same thing over and over. It's amazing how many times you have to communicate it to the team and you think to yourself, well, I've already shared this, but the reality is one of the key learnings for me, and like you, I'm still on that journey myself. It's one of the most fascinating parts of my job is managing people. People are complex, which is what makes, you know, what works for one person may not work for
exactly.
The other. But one of the big surprises for me is just how often you have to re-communicate that. So it sounds like it's been a great journey for you today. Chris, we thank you for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest this morning has been Chris Gibson. He's the co-founder and CEO of Recursion Pharmaceuticals. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Christian Camargo. You can hear my entire interview with Chris on our website, kcpw.org, or on The Bottom Line podcast. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.